We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. And we're also happy to once again to have here on the program Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. We do this program once a month on a Monday, and we do it so that you can have the chance to call in, ask home maintenance questions. Now, maybe you've got some problem that has come up here. You're not quite sure how to solve it. Or, as I said before the news, maybe something needs to be fixed. You're wanting to make some changes, doing some remodeling, whatever it is. You may have questions about heating and cooling, attics, basements, doors, windows, roofing, insulation. What have I forgotten? Probably a lot of things here. Any of the parts that go into the single-family home here. The idea is if you have a problem, call in and tell us about it. And Scott, we'll see if he can help you out. 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. Any point here, you're ready to go with your questions, you call us. Well, thanks very much.
Well, certainly, David. Always love to come in.
Anything in particular right now that's sort of on your mind that you might be good to remind people about?
Well, I'll tell you what. I ran into one the other day that kind of surprised me. I only had about 3.5 inches insulation up in the attic area. Of course, with our sudden cold spell, that's always a good thing to check. If your house doesn't have adequate insulation, particularly an attic area, is very easy to add. It does not take much. A contractor can blow it in and add enough insulation to help reduce your heating bills. Also, it really increases the comfort level of the house by reducing some of the heat loss. It gets rid of the cold ceiling. Right now, for our current energy prices and the ideas of how much insulation we should have, I would say that unless you've got at least 8 inches insulation, you need to add some. And ideally, you should have approximately 12 to 14 inches insulation in your attic.
Really?
Area.
14 inches, really? That much? And does it make more sense to do a blown-in product as opposed to a fiberglass bath that you lay in between your joists?
In my experience, the blow-in works quite well, particularly if it's an add-on. If you've already got some insulation there, the blow-in will fill in any low spots or any voids of the old insulation and give you a better coverage. And I also found that it was actually less expensive to hire somebody to do it than it was to go to one of the big box stores and buy the insulation and do it yourself.
Really?
Just from the fact that the guys that do the blow-in insulation can get a good deal on the insulation and then charge you the labor to put it in, and it only takes them a short period of time to blow it in, so there's not a lot of labor costs.
Okay. And would you expect them to also pay attention to where your soffit vents are to make sure that they don't end up being covered up?
Well, hopefully the contractors that are doing this would pay attention to that, yes, because we do need to watch our attic insulation. We do end up with a lot of frost and ice forming in the attic areas if we don't keep the soffits open and ventilating, as well as your gable vents or your ridge vents.
Okay. We've got several callers here. We'll get right into it and start with someone in Terre Haute, line number 4. Hello. Oh, hold on a second there. Hold on. There we go. Go ahead. Is there a caller there? Line 4, Terre Haute. Well, maybe we've got a little problem here. I'm not quite sure what the deal is. I tell you what, we'll see if we can get it straightened out, and we'll get to the call. So don't go away. Hang on there. Our guest this morning, this part of Focus 580, again, Scott Spies from Spies Home Inspection Service. Every month he's here on the program, and we welcome your questions and comments. Again, 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Okay, well, let's try Muhammad, line 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead.
I have cracks forming around my soffit above my refrigerator, and I know it must be from the weight of the refrigerator, which is probably heavier than ones they, you know, had 40 years ago when this house was built. What kind of a service do you call to go down in the crawl space and figure out where an extra support should be? You know, one of those poles that they put in. Who do you call to do that?
Well, most general contractors would be able to install a jack post if that's the problem. Now, the cracks you're referring to, are they in the ceiling area?
They're around the soffit. It was all plastered. It was sprayed with some kind of popcorn-y stuff, you know, and now that's all broken. And it looks like the soffit's coming down, but that doesn't make sense. I think it has to be the refrigerator's weight pulling the walls down or something.
Well, actually, I would be very surprised if that was the case. Generally speaking, when we start getting ceiling cracks, it's usually due to some movement in the trusses up in the attic area. How old is the house?
About 40 years old.
Okay. Well, without looking at it, I couldn't tell you whether or not it's a rafter or a truss situation. A truss, which, of course, is a triangle with a couple of web members or W members in the middle of it to add some strength, does not bear weight on the center of the house. It bears weight to the outside walls. And so you can actually get some movement of the ceiling up and down with different temperature changes and humidity changes in the house. Usually, if you have a crawl space support issue, you end up with rolls in the floor, things like that, but very rarely do they transfer actually to the ceiling. It'd be one of those things where somebody like myself, a home inspector, could come out and take a quick look at that and with a visual be able to give it a little bit better idea. My guess is that it's strictly a cosmetic problem, and then I doubt that there's a significant structural issue just from the description. Obviously, without looking at it, I can't guarantee that, but that is a very common area to get some movement. As wood dries out, when we get these cold snaps like what we've had in the last couple of weeks, where it gets very cold and very dry very quickly, the wood dries out, shrinks, and there is a little bit of movement. And, of course, the drywall in a house of that age, it doesn't move as much as it used to before it starts cracking. So you can end up with sudden cracks in the ceiling due to the wood movement from our temperature changes. But my guess is that it's not the refrigerator weight, but it would have to be looked into. A home inspector or a good, trustworthy general contractor would be who I'd recommend.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go over to someone in Indiana. This is Mill Creek Valley, Indiana, line 3. Hello.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. I'd like your opinion of eaves troughs or guttering, the necessity for having them. The reason I'm calling, our guttering is rather thin stuff, and getting the leaves out of it's a problem, especially one which is quite high off the ground. When I was much younger, I would tie a rope to a tree on one side and then go up the roof and down the other side and pull out the leaves. Then I got so I had a long ladder which I could lean against the house, not the eaves trough, against the house. And reach up over my head and feel for the leaves and pull them out. But now I've reached the glorious age of 78, and that seems like a long way down. So I'm wondering about the necessity. I could have somebody climb up on the one side that when there's a roof, and they can just climb up there and reach down and pick them out. I just did that this year, and it scared me to death. But on the other side, it's awful tough. My son did it, but I worried a lot about it. So how, in your opinion, I suppose it depends on individual houses, how important is guttering to a house, or eaves troughs, we call them?
All right. Well, the guttering on the house serves a purpose of collecting the water from the roof and allowing you to direct it out and away. In this area, central Illinois, we do have a lot of water problems in basements and crawl spaces due to the water from the roof being too close to the foundation when it soaks down and soaks through the foundation and eventually through the foundation into our crawl space or basement areas. So the guttering is a really good idea for collecting that water and getting it out and away. Now, depending on the exact soil composition where you're at and the drainage around your house as to how important it is, if you have absolutely no basement water problems or no water in the crawl space, it's nice and dry down there, then, of course, the gutters are less important. Oftentimes, we can take care of the water from the roof in other ways, such as a drained gravel bed where the water drips off the roof and runs straight down to the soil up next to the house. You dig a little trench and put a drainage tile and cover it with gravel and let the water fall off the roof into the gravel and into the tile. Then you run this drainage tile to a low area in the yard or towards the road ditch and get rid of it that way. So the guttering is not an absolute. It's not something that's needed on the house, but it does make a very convenient and inexpensive way of collecting the water from the roof and getting it well away from the foundation so we don't have foundation problems. So it depends. If you don't have a gutter system, then you need to have some type of drainage system, or you need to have a really good slope away from the house to reduce any what I'll call settlement problems. Most houses don't actually settle. Most houses stay firmly in place, and we get some cracks from wood shrinkage. But if you keep a lot of water next to the foundation, the soil around the foundation, which has, of course, some clay content, will expand and contract with different moisture changes. And if we keep it really saturated, that clay can actually flow or move out from underneath the footing. We can drop corners. Quite often you'll see on a brick veneer house a little stair-step crack coming off of the brick in the corner or near a window, indicating that there's been some movement. So in answer to your question, is a gutter imperative? No, gutters are not a requirement. However, depending on where you're at and what the soil makeup is, it's probably a very good idea to have them. There are different types of gutter guards, gutter helmets, screening systems, all of which work to some extent. None of them are, of course, 100% perfect. So guttering is one of those issues where it's kind of tricky to point out over the radio just exactly what is needed, but there are options.
Yeah. Well, on this side, it really bothers me a lot. The ground slopes down to the house, has a fairly steep slope to it. Would it be advisable then to dig that trench, put that tile in and gravel in?
Well, particularly if the rest of the yard slopes back towards the house, and that is a good idea to put in what I'll call a drained gravel bed. And that's where you actually cut a trench directly below the drip edge of the roof, slope the trench back upward towards the house, line it with a sheet of plastic, put in a perforated drainage tile, and then cover over the top of it with gravel. When the rain drops off of the roof, it will keep any vegetation or whatever from growing right there and along a little line underneath the roof. And it'll soak down through the gravel. It can't soak through the plastic, so it's got to go into your drainage tile, and then you have your drainage tile routed someplace around the house. That works quite well. Unfortunately, most of the time those tiles will fill up with dirt over the years. I think I installed a similar system one time. It's been almost 18 or 20 years ago, and yes, we're just now starting to have some water problems with it. So it's a good 20-year solution.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot. I used to talk to your dad once in a great while.
Yeah, well, he's always had a lot of fun doing this program, and he's the one that convinced me to come in here and sit with David for an hour every month.
I'm glad you've come along.
All right. Well, thank you. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Scott Spies is here from the Spies Home Inspection Service. We do this program every month on a Monday to give you a chance to talk about home maintenance. Just real quick, one question for anybody who's selling gutter cover systems, and if they say to you, you will never have to clean out your gutters again. Is that really true?
If you were to live out in the plains of Kansas where there are actually no trees, then there's a very good chance it's not going to happen.
Okay, as long as there are no trees around your house.
And a lot of it has to do with the type of vegetation around the house. I mean, if you've got a sycamore tree dropping leaves that are 6 inches in diameter, they can literally span the gutter and the water can run over the top of it.
Yeah.
Or we can get some of the maple seeds, or actually one of the worst one is pine needles. Pine needles will tend to go through almost every screen type material that's out there. So a lot of it has to do with the vegetation around the house and how far you've got it trimmed back and things like that. I mean, let's face it, Champaign Urbana is a Tree City USA type place, and yeah. We've got a lot of vegetation. So, and the price we have to pay is we have to clean the gutters once in a while.
All right. On to Terre Haute, line 4. Hello.
Hi there. Mm-hmm. The floor of my garage is as slick as glass and very, very dangerous. I'm wondering if there's anything that can be done about that.
Okay, slick. Has it been painted or anything like that?
No.
Huh.
No, the finish that they put on it was what made it so slick. It's nice when you're trying to sweep it, but it's really dangerous to walk on it, especially if there's any moisture at all.
Okay. Well, my recommendation then would probably be to apply some type of a paint or a textured coating over the top of it. If you look on some of the automotive websites, they have garage floor coatings. I believe U-Coat is one brand of it, which are basically it's a paint to kind of seal the concrete, but also they usually throw in some color flex for aesthetics and also to create a enough of a variation or texture that you don't have the slippage problem. It can be anywhere from as simple as when you mix up a can of floor paint to throw in a handful of sand. So when you paint it, it's got a little bit of texture. Now, that does make it a lot harder to sweep. One of the epoxy coatings, they're a little bit softer so that they're not quite as slick, particularly when wet. A little harder to apply. You've actually got to clean the concrete and then apply it to a two-part epoxy and get it to seal. But so there's several different things that you could do. But it sounds to me like you might look for a porch paint or a garage concrete paint. Okay. Something like that would probably be what you're looking for.
Okay, thank you.
All right, very good. Over to Belgium, line two. Hello.
Yeah, good morning, y'all. I've got a bit of a question. And your father and you, I don't know they're really given techniques on how to do construction very often, but I'm going to ask. I'm remodeling a bathroom. Bathroom's in a basement, concrete walls, okay? And I'm going to put up furring strips and stuff like that. And I put in a solid surface countertop and some cabinets I built. And now I'm working on doing around the shower. My wife was a school teacher, recently retired, very recently. And during her tenure as a teacher, she taught at one school until they tore it down around her. Actually, she did that to two schools, but that's another story. When they tore the last one down, I went in and got all the chalkboards that she used to stand in front of. Mm-hmm. And now they're about 42 inches by varying lengths, from anything from 6 foot to about 4 foot. And I'm going to use that as the splash around the shower so she can stand around it for the rest of her life. and so the question is, this slate, it's Vermont slate, so it's a nice real hard slate, not the kind of slate we have. And it varies in thickness a little bit, which I think I can deal with. But the problem is, how do I attach it to the wall? Now, like I said, I'm putting furring strips up and backer board behind this so that I don't have water problems and sealing it off that way. But I was wondering whether to use thin set to hold it, because this stuff is fairly seriously heavy. Or should I just I can mill out wood strips around the edge to form a Z-clip situation around the outside of it and hold it so it's not actually adhered to the walls and setting on the floor. What technique would you use?
Actually, I'd probably use a combination of the two. Because you're correct, the slate is a quite heavy material, and it is going to require some support. So if you've got something you can set it on, you're usually in pretty good shape. And if you've got a clip at the top that'll keep it from tilting back or out, you're pretty good. The thin slate set will hold it, because while the slate's quite heavy, as long as you've got a base or something for it to rest on at the bottom.
Well, I was going to set it on actually the pan. I built a concrete pan, so
okay.
So it should set firmly on that.
Yeah, you'll want to make sure you get a good seal right there to keep the water from wicking into the ends of the slate, because the slate is relatively porous.
Yeah, that's another question. The sealer for slate, should you seal both the front and back sides? Because like you say, it is very porous.
Well, I would make sure, in particular, the front and back would be a good idea, but in particular, make sure the edges get a good coating.
Oh, okay.
Because the edges is where the water is going to sit, particularly as the water runs down or capillary traction draws it in at a joint. So the edges are going to be very important. It would not hurt to do the back as well, but specifically the front and the edges would be your best bet.
I was thinking about, I don't know if you've ever dealt with these are your old original slate chalkboards. One side is very smooth, where they've milled it smooth for the teachers to write on.
Mm-hmm.
The other side comes more from the mill, or from the mine, I guess, or the quarry,
yeah,
I guess. And so it has rough textures on it. I was thinking about using that for the floor, because like the other lady said, there is a slickness problem there.
Yeah, the backside will be a more of a chiseled type effect,
yeah.
Where they've cut it loose, and they do make some sealers. And again, the usually the epoxy sealers are a little bit softer, so they're not quite the hard slick finish.
So, what kind would you suggest?
Well, depending on the look you're going for, most of the time for a floor, slate should be just fine the way it is. Just you want to put some sealer on the grout between the pieces so that they don't discolor over the time.
These pieces are big enough that I'm just not going to have grout joints. I mean, these pieces are large.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, my guess is for a floor situation, you're probably going to be in good shape. I would have to check with the flooring stores to see what they are recommending for a sealer. I haven't done a slate floor in quite some time. I know that the last one that I came across, we did not have to put much of a sealer on the slates themselves. We just had to put a sealer on the grout. So the slate does pretty well for your floor. I would definitely seal it for the shower where you're going to have a constant moisture source.
Yeah, okay.
But for the floor, I think it should be all right.
I noticed there are water-based sealers and there's oil-based sealers. And now you mentioned an epoxy-based sealer. I hadn't come across that particular one.
Well, epoxy is more of a coating than a sealer.
Oh, okay.
And it protects the top of it. It stays clear, but it protects the top so that we don't get any discoloration, don't get anything wicking down into it. The water-based and oil-based work quite well. They tend to hold the water on the surface, but can let a little bit of dirt and stuff into the tops. But it gives the natural look of the slate. It doesn't give it a gloss or a shine generally.
And one last question. I'm sure there's others. The water-based stuff, does it turn milky? I mean, you put it on kind of milky, and it dries and gets kind of clear, but over the years with water on it, will it rinse off and become milky or something?
Okay, that I have not had any experience with.
I see. Okay. Well, thank you very much, sir.
All right thank
We're
you.
We're on our midpoint here, and our guest is Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's here on the program once a month. On a Monday, we talk about home maintenance, and questions, well, they're welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Up next is someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
If you would please comment upon a practice that I think is wishful thinking on the part of the parties who practice it, and that would be packing bales of straw around the foundation of their house and or packing bales of straw around the foundation of their house and covering it with plastic. I'm thinking to hopefully provide some insulation to the foundation of the house. However, I sort of think that bales of straw aren't really all that good as insulators and would provide more problems than they would solutions and, you know, attracting vermin and moisture and other things like that. So if you would tell us what you know about using excessively all-natural means of energy conservation to insulate one's home. Thank you.
Well, the bales of straw actually are relatively good insulators. They do reduce a lot of air force, so the wind blowing at the house doesn't tend to blow underneath it. So, yes, I would have to say as an insulator, it does work well. Unfortunately, the problem we run into is most of the time it does get damp, and once wet, it does not insulate anywhere near as well, and then we end up with mold and mildew problems. And as you had mentioned, the vermin, it will provide a place for mice and rats to live, as well as various other different types of bugs and increased spiders around the house and things like that. So there are a lot of insulators out there that would work better than straw that would not necessarily insulate better, but would create fewer problems. A foam board would be one of them. And if you put a foam board on the exterior, then you put some type of concrete board or mortar mix over the top of it to protect it from sunlight. But the bales of straw or the bales of hay do actually function well, particularly if we can keep them dry by keeping some plastic or something over the top of them. But, yeah, from an aesthetics point, of course, that is not the the best way look on a house. I know I've seen quite a few trailers that are done that way where the underpinning, which is just a very thin metal skirt around the outside, does not stop much air, and they end up with a lot of frozen water pipes and such. And so it is one quick and easy way of temporarily, in my opinion, slowing the airflow down underneath and providing some insulation. But it is temporary. The bales of straw will deteriorate, ferment, and grow mold and mildew. So they do have to be changed out if you're going to keep them. And they usually don't add much to the resale of your house just from the looks. So while I can't say that it's not a good insulator, I can say that there are a lot better products out there.
All right. Other calls. Let's go next to Champaign County, line 3, right here. Hello.
Hi. I'm apologetic in advance. I actually got this answer or something towards an answer before, but I mislaid my notes. I'm looking what I'm calling now sash tracks. I want to rebuild some windows because I eventually want a sun space where my sort of sunroom is now on the outside of it, so I don't want to invest in windows, but I want to tighten them up. And I used to be able to. Some 15 years ago, I went out and just bought these aluminum sash tracks. Sash inserts is the wrong word because that gets you a whole window. I've got bounced around between the Champaign County and the U of I Extension and didn't really get any good satisfactions. There's really no Small Homes Council anymore. I think the name's changed. So I'm at a loss because I don't know. It used to be an off-the-shelf item, and now you have to have them custom-made, which I might have anyway because the windows are an odd size. So is there a place to check a website and contact somebody and have something ordered?
Yeah, they are still available. Not as widely as they used to be because more and more houses are being built with better windows, of course, and the better windows are not needing the tracks or the weather stripping that you're referring to. I do believe that we've got on our files the name of a couple of window manufacturers that still produce that kind of stuff. I'd have to check my computer at the house, but you're more than welcome to call over to the office. And Hank, who my father, who was with the Small Homes Council for 32 years, probably has an answer for that as far as to whom to call for window parts. I know that.
Is he listening to you today?
Actually, there's a good chance that he is.
but do you have a pamphlet available?
I don't have a pamphlet, but I do have a couple of manufacturers that will produce older window parts. Anything, I think just about anything and everything made for windows since about 1840. We found this company that, I don't know, the founder probably was born back about that time, but we managed to find window parts that were considered to be obsolete. And,
This would be something I'm willing to accept it in plastic just because the aluminum ones that I used to be able to get don't really provide a thermal break. So
right. You might be able to do a similar effect with one of these plastic V-strips, just a plastic weather strip that you could put across the bottom of the window and close the window, and it would provide a little bit of pressure to help seal the windows a little bit better.
Yeah, but that wouldn't really address what I'm thinking of. So I'm just thinking of some kind of track that you put in, you tear out the old stuff. It's done widely when you want to stuff your pulley.
Right.
Pulley, loaded.
Yeah, and as far as I know, that
window
stuff is still available.
But it's not off the shelf, because I've asked at all the big boxes. And
Unfortunately, they cater to volume, and there's not as many people.
Window,
yeah, there's not as many people replacing or repairing the windows as there are replacing the windows. So they'd rather carry the new windows than the parts for the old windows. But yes, the pieces are still available. I have seen them recently.
All right, thank you.
All right, well, let's see. Next caller would be in Champaign, and line number 2. Hello.
Yeah. Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Rather, because I know the different cellulose and fiberglass, but what would be the ARVE that you'd shoot for, you know, sort of minimum or whatever for the attic?
I do believe the new recommended insulating value is like an R50 or R55 at the moment because of our energy costs. I know that the R30 is approximately an 8-inch fiberglass bat. The R50 is one of those things where unless I was doing new construction, I probably wouldn't be all that worried about trying to hit that. It gets to the point where more insulation gives you a diminishing return. Insulation is basically is rated with an R value, which is an inverse proportion to the heat loss. So if I've already got an R30, to change it from an R30 to an R50, I'm really not saving much more than, I don't know, what, 1/30th of my current heat loss. So it's one of those things where once you've got 8 to 10 inches, it's hard to say, gosh, I need to go add another 7 or 8 inches. But if you've got 3 to 6 inches, I would say, yes, you definitely probably need to bump it up to, say, 10 or 12 inches or better. But, yeah, I think the current one for this area, there are regional maps. The farther north, of course, would require more insulation, and down south a little bit less. But it, for this area right now, I think they're recommending between an R50 and an R55.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot.
All right, very good. Let's see. Next caller, I believe, should be Champagne again, and this is line one. Hello.
Did you say line one?
Yes, go ahead. Yes, good. Line one.
I
yes.
have two questions. One is I have vents in my bathrooms on the second floor of my house, and they seem to go up toward my attic. They do go up toward my attic. And I'm just wondering if this is eventually going to create moisture problems there.
It varies. Hopefully, when they installed them, they ran them up to the attic, but then made a 90-degree elbow and have them venting out towards your soffit ventilation so that the moisture can actually dissipate. If it is indeed going directly into the attic, it can be an issue if the attic does not have adequate ventilation. Now, last time I read the code book, it did give very specific measurements as to how many square inches of openable area for how many square feet of attic area we needed for ventilation and what percentage need to be up high and which percentage need to be down low. And I seem to recall the very last sentence of the paragraph was if deemed necessary.
Now, my attic seems to be well ventilated, I think. I see vents along the house. I don't see anything coming out the side, though, for the fans, but how would you know if you're having problems if you don't go into your attic much? It's not a very accessible attic.
Well, the tighter it is, of course, the more important it is to get more moisture out of it. But if it is well ventilated, then it's not not necessarily detrimental to have a bathroom vent fan going up there. Ideally, we don't want the fan blowing directly onto any of the wood framing or wood sheathing because we don't want to have any condensation issues. So the fan should at least be directed to where it blows out into a void or open area or towards a vent. Unfortunately, without looking in the attic, there is no good way of telling until the shingles start curling above the bathroom, and generally that's later than what you wanted to start with. So it's one of those things on a good cold snap, when you've got a day that's about 40 degrees and all of a sudden we drop down to about 10 or 20 degrees, pop that attic access open, and if there's frost on the sheathing directly over that bathroom, then you know that you're getting a little too much humidity in that area.
Oh, that's a good suggestion. I have another short question, if that's okay.
Sure.
Yeah.
I have a porch, covered porch, with a railing around the side, and I used to own an old house, and I never had any problems with the railing. And the newer house I bought, the railing seemed to be rotting. Why is that?
Probably the quality of the lumber used for the handrail or how well it was treated. Over the years, they have changed some of the pressure treating systems. When you get pressure treated wood, some of the good stuff they no longer use because it contained arsenic, things like that. So they've changed several of the formulas. And it also depends on what quality wood that they had when they started to do the pressure treating. Nowadays, the trees that we're getting are nowhere near the quality we used to. We're harvesting second and third generation growth lumber, which is basically farm raised lumber, so where they fertilize it and water it so it grows faster, so it's not as dense to begin with. Whereas the older lumber, where we cut it out of a natural forest, it was a lot denser, had a lot more rings between the outside and the center of the tree.
Is cedar a good choice?
Cedar is a very good choice in that cedar has some very normal natural oils and inhibitors to prevent deterioration. It's still a good idea to put some type of a UV coating on the cedar, but it does not rot as easily. It's more resistant to that.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Just one real quick thing, and I know this is something that your dad, I've heard him say this about a thousand times. One of the tip-offs, if people are wondering, do I have enough attic ventilation? Now's the time. When it is below freezing, you want to go up there. And he always said, now look up and look for some places where there are nails. coming through,
mm-hmm.
The nails that they use to put on the shingles. And if you see a little ball of ice on the tip of that nail, that should tell you that you do not have enough ventilation in your attic.
Well, you don't have enough ventilation for the amount of humidity up there. You may have enough ventilation if you've got a water problem in the crawl space and you're still ending up with that kind of an issue. Most of the ventilation will help reduce the moisture condensation in the attic. But if you've got an excessive moisture source somewhere, like a vapor barrier in a crawl space not installed properly or not there, or water on top of the vapor barrier, or a power humidifier set too high, it doesn't really matter how much attic ventilation you've got. You can still get that frost on the nail head.
So that could be a sign that you got a moisture problem somewhere.
That is correct. I was just in an attic last week where one side of the attic was just dripping wet, the other side was dry, and the homeowner's like, well, how come only one side's getting wet? It's like, well, the sun's hitting the south side warming it up, so it's drying, and the north side just happened to have a little bit more frost on it. Sure enough, I went down into the crawl space, and there's almost 3 inches of standing water in the crawl space. So I determined that it probably was not an attic ventilation issue that was creating the water problem in the attic, but more the fact that we had an excessive amount of moisture in the crawl space or in the house in general, and we were getting some condensation somewhere.
Okay, so it's slightly more complicated maybe than I remembered. All right, very well. Let's go to somebody on cell phone here, line four. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I wanted to get your opinion. We're going to build a shop and wanted your ideas on using P2000 both underneath the concrete floor and for sidewall insulation. Just what your opinion is on that or if there's a better insulation product to use.
Actually, that works very well, particularly perimeter edging, so that we don't end up with the concrete slab getting cold at the outside edge. So I would say, yes, that is a very good way of doing it. One of the things I like to see done also is a spray urethane on a shop, because quite often the shop will have a lot more higher humidity levels than a house. Just from normal going in and out, and particularly if you happen to use a tin or a metal roofing, then you need something that will basically be a vapor barrier airflow protector. And so the spray urethane does a really nice job. They've got some urethane. They also have some bio foams, basically soybean oil foams, things like that. Fiberglass does not work well on metal roofing because it tends to hold too much moisture and get wet, and the fiberglass gets damp and heavy and wants to fall off. But so you need something that's got a good vapor barrier to it. But, yeah, and pay particular attention to your edge insulation because it's amazing how much heat loss you can lose through your concrete just permeating out to the outside perimeter where it's exposed to cold temperatures.
Yeah, we want to do a heated floor, so we want to make sure and hold as much heat in as we can.
Yep. Yeah, okay. The last time I put in a concrete slab, we ran a couple of loops of PEX down through it, and so we could run some hot water through it if we ever needed to. Didn't bother hooking up a system, but if we ever needed to, we had some loops of hot water we could run around the outside, hook a hot water up heater to it, and pump it through with basically a glycol mixture instead of actual water, so you didn't have any freezing. But just to heat the outside edge, it was amazing how much difference it could make.
Uh-huh. Okay, thank you.
All right, very good. Let's go to Coles County, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
I was listening to the discussion earlier about using straw for insulation. Our house, we have a crawl space, and the window well and the window access to the crawl space happens to be built right under the kitchen sink. So it's a really wonderful way for the kitchen sink pipes to freeze. So every winter for years, I've been putting a bale of straw on top of the window well to kind of insulate that. And I don't need the vermin. I don't need the mildew. And, I don't need the staining on a brand new siding we put on. So I'm wondering if you have another suggestion how I can insulate that window well section so that my kitchen, so our water pipes don't freeze, besides using a bale of straw.
All right. Generally speaking, when we get a frozen water pipe, it's not necessarily that the entire length of pipe reached a temperature where we're going to create ice. Usually it is one or two small places where a little bit of wind is able to get to it and it makes a pinpoint spot of ice, and as that pinpoint freezes and creates a block and then expands, it pushes pressure in either direction, and usually the direction which has the valve turned off, no relief for the water pressure building up, and we build enough pressure that we burst the pipe. So very rarely is a burst pipe due to the entire thing freezing, but more an ice plug someplace. So probably what I would recommend is in the band joist area, a spray urethane foam, because that'll seal your sill plate and your top plate and the band joist and reduce any air movement around in that area.
Spray the pipes or?
I would start by spraying the framing. The urethane foam will create a good insulator, but it will also create an air barrier, so we don't have the air movement blowing on the pipes. And then probably on your crawl space access, if you could attach a piece of styrofoam or something on the inside to give you a little bit of an insulation quality. So when you closed it, you just glue it with some it depends what your cover is made out of is how you would attach it.
It's glass.
Okay, it is glass.
Glass window.
Okay. Well, a storm window on it, or again, if it were mine, I would probably paint the glass on the inside and then put the styrofoam on it so you didn't show from the outside, because glass does not make a good insulator. But I would put I'd attach a piece of styrofoam to the inside of it. But the spray urethane foam is going to be what's going to cut down on the air leakage, and that's my guess is that somewhere you've got air blowing between the sill plate and the foundation. And at that point in time, that's where it's that or that point in the crawl space is where we're actually freezing our pipe. So that a urethane foam would probably be the best choice for that area.
All righty. Thank you very much.
All right. Very good. Well, lines are free here, and we have maybe about 10, 12 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Scott Spies is here from the Spies Home Inspection Service. It's our monthly show on home maintenance, and if you have a question, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Maybe I'll just ask a question, and I know this is something that has come up on and off over the years, and people are concerned about cold basements. And then, how that translates into cold first floors for people who have basements. And from time to time, people have said, well, I've been thinking about insulating the floor, that or what would be in the basement would be the ceiling. And I think the advice from you and your dad has been, no, you don't want to insulate the floor. You want to insulate the walls.
The perimeter walls. Yes.
So now, why is it that you want to do you don't want to do the floor, but you want to do the walls?
Well, the basement is generally what I will consider a semi-heated portion of the house. Even if you don't have the furnace down there, the floor, the concrete floor, as well as the concrete walls below grade, will stay at about 50 or 55 degrees pretty much year-round. And obviously 50 or 55 degrees is not enough to freeze pipes and relatively easy to heat up to normal interior temperature of 68, 70 degrees, something like that. Mm-hmm. Whereas most your heat loss is actually going to the soil, which is sucking the heat off of the foundation walls. So if you can put in the top portion, generally speaking, the foundation sticks about 8 to 10 inches above the outside soil level. And so that portion of the foundation is exposed to outdoor temperatures. So if it's 30 degrees outside, obviously it's exposed to 30-degree weather. If it's zero out, that top block is our top section of the wall could be exposed to that zero-degree temperature. Once we get down about 6 or 8 inches, we're probably down to about the frost line, which means 32 is about as cold as that section of the wall is going to get. Mm-hmm. And then we go down to 20 mm-hmm. inches or so, and that's where we start getting into the 50, 55 degrees. So the top, I'd say 3 feet would be the most important portion of your foundation. Kind of depends on how you use your basement also. If you spend a lot of time in the basement, your body acts as a radiant heater and you will radiate heat towards a cold surface. So if you have a wall, even though it's 50 degrees, you can feel cold down there, even if the room temperature or the basement temperature is fairly normal. It's 65, 68, something like that. You can still feel cold. And by putting a little bit of insulation on the walls, you can create a barrier between yourself and the cold spot. So then the basement instantly gets more comfortable, whether it got warmer or not. Isn't necessarily true, but it did get more comfortable because now you're not radiating heat towards it. But for what our caller was calling about with frozen water lines, the spray urethane for like a kitchen area, you can buy it in a can, seal the foundation to the sill plate and seal around the box sill to really insulate things if we've got a lot of problems or we're really trying to get energy efficient. They do make a commercial grade foam, obviously not the spray can, so you can do the entire band joist or even the foundation walls. If you use any foam type insulation inside of a basement area, It is supposed to be covered with a fire retardant material, either a fire treated paneling or a type X drywall, something that will give a slight fire protection between the living space and the foam, because the foam, if burned, will put off toxic fumes. So you do have to be careful when using foam insulation in basement areas. Crawl space areas, it's generally accepted that we can get by without it. In this area, I have come across areas that have insisted that even crawl space foam have a drywall or fire retardant over the top of it. I generally figure that a crawl space doesn't have enough stuff to catch on fire, that the chances of, and fire likes to go uphill, not downhill, that I don't think that is as critical in a crawl space, but I have found places where it says, yes, you do have to cover it even in a crawl space. But a general rule of thumb is foam in a living area should be covered with a fire resistant material. While it's a good insulator, we need to make sure that it's protected.
Okay. We have another call here on the toll-free line, Clark County, line 4 here. Hello.
Hello. Thank you very much for taking my call. Last week, I attended a presentation regarding an insulation product that goes in your crawl space in the ceiling. It's a foil-type product, roughly 3/16 of an inch thick, and it's laid out over the top of your current insulation, and was touted to be able to reduce your heating or cooling costs by over 40%. I don't know anything about it. It seemed interesting, but also very expensive. I wonder if you have an opinion on that.
Generally speaking, the foil insulations are what we call reflective insulators. They do have their place. There are certain times when they do work, and when you have the right ideal combination, I can agree that, yes, you could probably save that much. However, I'm going to say that the general application, you're not going to save anywhere near that much. The reflective, it kind of depends on how your house is heated and how you're currently insulated. If you've got a heat duct system in a crawl space, putting additional foil-faced insulation or foil-type insulation in the crawl space on the floors is going to insulate between you and the heat ducts that are losing heat. So I don't think that makes sense. Reflective insulation works well for attic areas for reducing cooling problems. You put it over the top of the insulation. When the attic gets really hot, it doesn't allow the heat to dissipate down into the house, so you don't have to spend as much time cooling. It does. Most of the foil films also are a good air barrier, and as an air barrier, they can actually increase the efficiency of any existing insulation. So I'd say there's no blanket thing that says, hey, I can save you X amount of energy loss on any type of situation, because there are so many different ways that insulation is used in so many different places. If I had a home with an all baseboard electric heat, then yes, I would probably be putting a radiant or a reflective insulation on the floor of my crawl space so that any heat I'm generating upstairs does not go down to the crawl space. But if you've got a forced air furnace where you've got a ductwork and such in the crawl space, it's probably not going to do anything for you and could actually reduce some of the heat gain you're getting off your ductwork.
Okay, this house is relatively new. It's 2x6 framing on the outside walls. And we have a full basement, so all the ductwork is in the basement. The crawl space is just that. It's not used for storage or anything, but it's quite large, and part of it's a cathedral ceiling.
Okay.
I just don't know whether the application would have been over $5,000 for my house, so I don't know whether it's worth it or not, I guess.
I would have to say for that kind of an expenditure for insulation that you are definitely looking at a long-term payback, because particularly with the extra thick wall insulation, I will admit that a well-insulated house or well-wall insulation good insulation in the walls and in the ceiling area, we can have as much as 10 to 15% of our heat loss through the floor area. However, that is assuming that you don't have any insulation in the crawl space. I personally prefer insulating the perimeter walls of the crawl space rather than the floors between the living area and the crawl space,
okay,
just because I know that there is ductwork running through that crawl space area. There has to be ductwork running to the outside edge of the room that your crawl space is over. So yep, by insulating the perimeter walls and keeping the outside air or the cold foundation walls from sucking the heat or the heat radiating towards the outside, I would much prefer to see it around the outside edges and not necessarily on the floor itself. Again, this is assuming that we do have a forced air furnace system, which is what we generally find in this area.
Yeah, that's what we have, yeah. Yeah, and there's no, as I said, this is a full basement, so there's no crawl space beneath the floor. It's a ranch house, so.
Okay. Well, then I definitely, you know, I would not be insulating my upstairs floor from my basement.
Okay.
I think that would be counterproductive, particularly for a high dollar application.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you very much. Right. I appreciate that.
We have a couple minutes left. We'll try to get, we have one more caller here. We got line one in Urbana. Hello.
Hi, yes. I'm a sort of home do-it-yourselfer, and I was wondering if there was any good guidance on how to keep my do-it-yourself work compliant with the code, if there was like code books or references that would be appropriate for that.
Well, of course, a copy of the code book is available. It's sort of like trying to read stereo manual. It's very long and boring and very difficult to interpret, but there are code books out there. I don't, at the top of my head, know of any publication that kind of gives you an overview. I'm reminded of the computer books for dummies. That's something I should get into.
You write that book.
At one point in time, yeah. I know that we did the Small Homes Council. My father, they did publish a book. I believe it was 1001 Ways to Save Energy. They gave a lot of energy tips. But as far as general do-it-yourself, actually, Time Life Books has a very good collection of home-type repairs and home-type maintenance. And it's a lot of volumes of books, and they like to charge a lot of money for them, but it's actually pretty good information.
Cool. Where I lived previously in Virginia, they had in the hardware store, they had a little spiral-bound like electrical guides that just kind of showed you some best practices that were fairly easy to read, but I guess that's not available around here.
I'll be quite honest, I think it would be a great idea, but no, I don't know of any source for that at this point.
Cool.
I wish I could help on that.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it at that because we're here at the end of the time. We want to thank Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service for being here. He's here once a month, and we'll do it again in January. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you very much, David.
Appreciate it.